episode 43. Here we are, all the horrible things.
Man, time flies. 43 already.
I'll say, we're here recording on the 25th of the 23rd year of the 2000s. And when you listen to this on Friday, hopefully you have seen both Megan and Skinamarink. A rinky dink, yeah, Skinamarinky do. Did I ever tell you I love you, Chris?
No, but
well, there you go. I love you, buddy.
I love you too. I thought this always would have happened over some beers or something. Yeah.
Nope. It took an existential horror film about children essentially stuck in hell. And, yeah. I'm looking forward to talking about it, even though I got issues. Big issues.
Right. Right. There are many things to be said about Skinamarink. And I just before we were recording, I said I think one of my favorite descriptions of it from a reviewer on Letterboxd was that it was like watching the final scene in Blair Witch, but as an entire movie.
Yes. And that's very accurate. I think that,
yes. And while I think that's accurate, I think I enjoyed the end of Blair Witch more than this entire movie.
Better than the whole movie. I'm going to be honest with you. I saw it in the theater. It's the first movie in a long time where people were walking out in droves. It was at the Music Box.
Really?
It was filled to capacity. You could tell that it had like screening passes. There was definitely representatives from some of the local guys around here that do movies who had obviously given out free passes for people to see this, because I went in not knowing nothing. I didn't see any review. I just heard the name. And I didn't even associate it with the kids' song at first, because it's been that long. I was immediately like, ooh, is this an evil roller rink? Or are we going to see some people get skinned? I had no concept until I was in there that we're dealing with kids in some form or another. How much did you know going in?
Nothing. And as a matter of fact, I looked at the description really quick on my phone just because I was a little confused at the start of the movie, and I went to IMDb really quick and I looked down and it's, I mean, it is such a vague but spot on description.
Right.
Let me just read it really
quick. Like two kids wake up and can't find their parents.
Yes. Yes. Two children wake up in the middle of the night to find their father is missing and all the windows and doors in their homes have vanished. Now, I hadn't even gotten to any of the vanishing. I was just trying to figure out, I'm like, okay, what point of view of this movie am I supposed to be watching? Because I was confused maybe like within the first 10 minutes. I don't even think we see things start to disappear. And I was just confused. Like, who are we, the audience?
I think we're Kevin probably throughout, right? There's two kids. Okay. There's Kaylee and Kevin. From what I gather, it's either Kevin or maybe it pops into the demon's view sometimes, because you do see Kevin in front. So it's got to be like, I think it's a hybrid of those two, maybe. You're right. It is a little confusing in whose perspective we're taking, because we do see the kids. So the times that we do see both the kids, I think it's either just sloppy, maybe in the way that it's not clear, or he's trying to make it seem like it is the demon's view or whatever this being is. But why would the being just fixate on corners of the ceiling?
Exactly.
I could understand that. I mean, there's even moments that, though. That's why I feel like it's primarily Kevin's perspective. And maybe Kevin's even given these images like in his head of something watching him. Because I'm just going to go out and give my theory. I think this is a child's hell. Like Kevin is in hell, maybe Kaylee too, but definitely Kevin is in hell. But if you are so young that you have no sort of like context for what hell would be, you're only drawing from the things that trouble you and annoy you as a kid as your representation of this existential hell, right? So for me, as a kid, boredom was my number one, holy shit, kill me sort of thing. This is horrible.
Yeah.
Oh, when I'm not being entertained in any way, there's no entertainment, which is essentially what they did to us. Because the entertainment value of this, I think, is slim. The philosophical value is high for me. If you go into this as a piece of art instead of a piece of entertainment, I think it has correct chops as that. But yes, this is not for everybody. I wanted to walk out, but I felt an obligation to sit through it. I was obligated. And I almost think that's how kids feel when they're doing something they don't want to do. We were made to feel like a kid in hell.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you're pretty spot on there. And let's double down on that. This is not an entertaining movie in that regard. It is all now. It's been a while since I've looked at a film from almost purely a production value, and I question, was the filmmaker adding the extra grain to this because it wasn't shot on film? Were they adding the extra grain to give you that childlike feeling waking up in the middle of the night and trying to just figure some like a shape out in the corner of your room? And that's the only thing I could really, as far as like the camera's point of view.
Yeah, if you actually want to talk about the actual aperture, I think it is then pointing to this being the children's perspective, in that kids don't have that full crispness on life, and that there's going to be this kind of like immature vision. And then that's manifested through what was actually used to film it, or the lens, or the, I'm sorry, filter that was put on it, whatever it is. I think it was purposeful, which gets me to one of the things that's popping up all over the net, is saying that it's pretentious and self-serving. What do you think about this?
Self-serving to a regard. Yeah, I would say I was almost as a viewer slash filmmaker, annoyed that the filmmaker was almost getting away with something, because this movie has already made a lot of money.
Right. It's $15,000 and it's already just past the $1 million mark. So in terms of that, we got to give, what is this, Kyle Edward Ball, we got to give him credit for that, because that's outstanding.
Credit. And
I'm supporting
for sure
indie horror 100%. I just, now that he might have a platform to make something more, I hope he does acknowledge what was lacking in this one that he can improve upon with more money.
Oh, you know, like a Jason Blum will come knocking on his door because they love what you can do with a little bit of money, and the return is exponential. Now, again, I don't want to trash filmmakers, because I think if you were to get, like, in an interview with this, a lot would be, you know, your eyes would open a little bit more. But yeah, I mean, I was a little bit annoyed, like trying to like lean in and figure things out. It's not to be consumed the way that a film should be.
And that's a point that I was hoping we'd get to. So as noted, I did see it in the theater. People walked out, but there was a handful of people at the end that clapped and were clearly just mesmerized by what they had just seen. Wholly sucked in. Maybe they had the good reefer or something where they really got sucked into the point of just it being an immersive experience. But I think that was my problem, was seeing it with such a large audience where the takes on it were so variant that I couldn't get sucked in. That being said, I think it's a movie designed to be watched alone in a dark room. If you have the luxury of going to the theater alone, that might be, if there's no one else in the theater, go see a matinee or something if it's still out there.
Right.
But I wish I had seen it alone without everyone else's energy around me, where I felt like I was then more Kevin, more of the character, more kid-like, versus the adult who just spent $30 to see that. You know.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. That makes a ton of sense. And you know what's interesting? I don't know if I've got anything else left to say about this movie.
As the deconstructor that I am, I do want to talk a little bit about the meaning, because I think maybe he was trying to go for the child abandonment, child abuse stuff, and how your world feels like it's turned upside down, because half this movie is essentially stuff stuck to the ceiling, or the kid walking on the ceiling toward his essentially slaughter after we learn that he's been there for 532 days.
Yeah.
And I actually do appreciate how... Well, what it's saying is, like, I think you noted this earlier. It's like your eyes can play tricks on you when you are so bored or you're so just like void of a sense of purpose. You see things that aren't there. And I kept, when they switched to these different, essentially it was like a slideshow movie. That's what I keep thinking of it as. It was a slideshow.
Yeah.
But the longer I just like looked at some of these images that were held up there for way too long, I did start having weird thoughts of my own. You know what I mean? It was more of a experiential piece of work than it was anything for me, because I started thinking about my own processes as a moviegoer. And I gotta give it credit in that it's the first movie in a long time where, like, Mara and I talked a shit ton about it, even though we both hated it. Like, we talked about this movie a lot afterwards, trying to determine if our disdain for it is valid or if we were really just missing the plot, because there's no plot, you know.
That's where, when you mentioned earlier, like, some sort of pretentiousness could come into play, like when you as a as a viewer feel bad that you may have missed something.
Right. And that's why I think, you know, maybe I'm stretching for some of these assessments. But we see a lot of scenes of these just Lego piles, right? First of all, somebody on Reddit noted that a lot of those were pieces beyond 1995's Lego lineup sort of thing. There's contemporary pieces when it's supposed to be 1995. But that's not that big a deal. I was trying to determine why we were seeing so much of the Legos. And again, I go back to this idea that it's a child's hell with very little to go off of in terms of creating something that's scary and horrific for a kid. And beyond, you know, feeling like you lost your parents, which is the overt one, or are you being abandoned, essentially, there's the Legos in them getting sucked under the bed. And I think the sense of your toys have been stolen, because we don't have any sense of how long they were gone for. I'm digging deep here. But as a kid, when you have your toy taken away from you, right, it's the end of the world. Additionally, I think it's interesting that we see the Legos built in kind of a fashion that's advanced. We see these structures. And to me, again, it's toys that are outside of their reach because they're stuck in this perpetual childhood. Yes, they can play these advanced Legos with their parents there directing them, but it's not Duplo. You know what I mean? They can't play with those toys on their own, which is another form of hell for a child who has no sense of serial killers or Freddy Krueger and stuff like that, you know? And if I may, I want to jump into that, to the next aspect that is such a big part of it that probably annoyed the pants off of most people, was the looping cartoon. He's using stock footage from archive.org of this old, it looked like a 30s cartoon. This is 1995. What's worse than being forced to watch a cartoon that you don't want to watch, right? It's black and white, and it's 1995, so the kids are not used to this.
In lieu of color. So,
we obviously as an audience need some sort of light to play off of it. So in a way I kind of started to buy into, okay, the kids are going to get sick of this after the first viewing, let alone over a year forever of the same thing playing, you know? So felt like there was things that were really interesting in terms of creating a child's hell, but I haven't seen a lot of takes saying that it's a child's hell on there and that it's mostly like this existential sort of metaphor. But I would go as far to say it is definitely a hell based on some of the stranger shots that we get, including the house in this dark void, the outside of the house we only see once that it cuts to in this void of nothing around it. And there's also the door at the end, essentially when he's done, when he dies. Kevin, you see that like kind of like door that he's actually going to get out of this house, but what's around the house? Like nothingness, you know?
Nothing. Right. Yeah. After all that time, you go to, and then it's almost questioning what's worse. Right. What would you rather have?
Yeah. I see, in that sense, there was some existential dread that was palpable, but other people online talked about how if they had given us a more traditional beginning, where maybe we did get to meet these characters and then there was a transition into this sort of strange display, it might have been way more effective, but there was nothing for us to latch onto at all. to begin right. with, you know, which
yeah
was hard.
Yeah, and the only other thing I would really question is, like, and I don't know if it's just part of the whole tying into Skinamarink, when the doors and, like, when things disappear, there's yes. that almost that 1970s style sound of, like, bling,
like right. Again, I'm probably stretching with this, but just, like, kids are susceptible to not knowing, like, material permanence. It's the peekaboo effect. You know, was that there? Where would you right. go? Where'd you go right. sort of thing. And as right. they're kind of dissolving in.
Magic.
Nothing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. For sure. Yeah. I appreciated what was embedded. It just was not delivered in a way that is compelling, I feel like, for the majority of audiences.
And you know what also is super interesting is... when you have a movie like this that relies on static images and
a lot of just black
lingering, lingering shots, how do you land on a runtime?
Mm.
And did it need to be this length? Was it a certain level of time of torture?
Right. It is based on a short called Heck. So that to me then again points to the idea of a child's hell. Right? Because if the short yeah, that this is heck. Based on is called Hack, that is what I
That's
think he was.
True.
And I had read somewhere that his his inspiration for this was he had asked on Ask Reddit, what nightmares did you have as kids? What do you remember?
Interesting.
From childhood, sleeping and just having the sense of dread associated with that. And he just like swirled it all up and then threw it there. Yeah. But some stuff stuck, some stuff didn't stick. Like the toys in the ceiling or in the wall, it was just too cliche for me. Wasn't doing anything. But there were some things right. I did like. The demon's laugh. I don't know if you remember it, but the demon's yes. laugh is legitimately oh, scary. Yes. There are some jump yeah. scares. Some people were talking about how using a, a Blair horn for the jump scares is just cheap and that it's not yes, an earned scare. And I agree with mm-hmm. that. And the first scare didn't get me where you see the no face, no eyes, Kelly, where she's been changed right. by the monster. But the one with the anthropomorphic telephone as a kid that we all had, you're looking at it and it looks normal.
It's super eerie though.
And then it has its eyes bulge out at you all of a sudden. And this is right before Kevin is slaughtered and that's on loop too. So sense of hell just like dying over and over again, which is, you know, a trope you see right, a lot of people right. stuck in hell. That worked for me. There was some subtle stuff like the VCR, maybe that was playing the cartoon, presumably, like ended and started to rewind like right before like the climax where we do lose the kid. I don't know if mm-hmm. these were like signifying purposeful things purposeful. Or if I'm really yes. just digging deep. Then, of course, one of the more stranger parts would then toward the end when you see the pictures without heads. And I think that was him no longer remembering what family was. And once he'd lost any sense of what was dear to him, there's no more hell. He's got nothing to lose anymore sort of thing.
Right. There's no more you.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you can only scare based on context. And if you've done the same old mm-hmm. tricks for 532 days, it's not going to work anymore. But you got to kill the kid and move on to the next.
Right.
Torture. Yeah, you look pained even talking about this.
There's a lot to be discussed. You're right, but you're almost wondering, like, even at the top of the film, instead of telling us that you don't own the rights to the cartoons, maybe you also suggest that this was like you do in an improv scene, like this is you're now about to see a scene based off the suggestion.
Yeah, that would have been more interesting. I think it would have helped people along because without any frame of reference, it did become a chore to watch. And if that was part of it,
I didn't know that. I mean,
it's a rare instance where knowing a little bit about it beforehand, it would help. And I did read that watching it the second time is way better than the first because you do know what you're expecting. But who's got 140 minutes to spare just staring at the ceiling again for, you know, a cumulative 5 minutes of interesting visuals.
I would say watching it a second time, the benefit would be knowing the moments that you need to pay the most attention to.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, when you're anticipating something. Yeah.
Yeah. That's I mean, all. I could That's see all. Like if I were to have children, a punishment for them would be to watch this movie.
Sure. You know, and I say, eat your vegetables. Now that's what's going to happen to you if you don't eat your vegetables. Yeah. You will be sent to your room and watch Skinamarink on repeat.
Yeah, that'd be your homework. Pretty bad. Yeah, I mean, there was some scary-ish moments, just like the impressionability of the kid, too, and like put the knife in your eye. There's so little things that this human has. That was the conversation.
The conversation with like the 911 operator, I mean, may have been one of my more favorite scenes, just because you're getting those responses from a child. You're getting the cliche things adults say to children, like, I need you to be brave now.
Right. Yes. I wanted to talk about that scene because I wasn't exactly sure what happened, but I think because the last thing she says to is, okay, just wait on the line here with me, honey.
Right.
And then nothing. Mm-hmm. And then like a frame later or whatever, you see just he dropped the phone. So I'm assuming he waited there for days. You know what I mean? If it's 532 days, he was just forced to like wait on the line. Another just like forcing a kid to wait for something is nightmarish.
Yeah. Maybe if this child was, you know, dead or in this hell, maybe these are moments plucked from the moments leading up to the actual death, you know, that are just playing on repeat in your head.
Yeah, because we do actually have the father's voice at the beginning and the mother's voice at the beginning.
Right.
And the father mentioned something about him having had an accident and that he's okay. Mm-hmm. But what if he's not? What if that's what led to his death?
That's what this whole thing is.
He cracked his head when he fell off his bike or whatever it was, and he's actually dead. And making him feel like he's alive is what then enables the scare.
Yes, and then the idea of putting or trying to recollect what happened to you, you know? Mm-hmm. I don't know. Maybe that's...
So, I mean, yeah, you're right. I'm good on this one, too. I would say if you're a super horror fan, you got to watch it. But anybody who's a casual fan, you can skip this one forever.
And, you know, having said all of that, and it's okay to dislike things, I super appreciate the fact you've got filmmakers out there trying to do something new.
Yeah, absolutely.
So thank you for that.
And just and I admire him for making money off of $15,000 like that with something that is so niche, it feels like. I got to give credit where credit's due.
Yep.
But I'm looking forward to his next outing. Let's say that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, I watched Pie. Like did you ever see Darren Aronofsky's Pie? That was really cheap. It's a hard watch. But then Darren Aronofsky went off to be like one of my favorite directors of all time. So.
Right.
It's the starting point for what could be a really interesting auteur. We'll see. But let's move on to Megan.
Let's move on to another child's nightmare.
Essentially, yes. Thematically, these two are linked.
They do pair.
Which making a lot of money off of nothing. And then you got Megan, which is a big hit. It's already got Megan 2 is in the works. But we're talking mainstream. We're talking a lot of tropes that we've seen before, a storyline we've seen before. But it does it in a unique enough way that I'm pro Megan.
I'm super pro Megan because, you know, a few years ago when they remade Child's Play or Chucky, you know,
this
is almost like what that should have been. You should have taken what the real advancement is here, and it's AI. Mm-hmm. And it's real. People use it right now. College kids are using it to write essays. Students are probably cheating all the time.
Art but now is AI, being taken over by AI. You just plug in, I want to see an elephant on a cloud, and it'll make, you know, Picasso-esque image of that. Yeah, it's doing everything. Yeah. You're right.
Right. But it is a real opportunity to take horror into a new updated direction.
That's true. Yeah. Because primarily when we see robots, it's usually just sci-fi. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's a small list of films that actually does this in the horror genre. Oh, I had it before. Killer robots in film. What do we got? We got Metropolis is number one, back all the way in 1926. Then we jump to 2001, A Space Odyssey, Westworld, 1973, Stepford Wives. I never saw the original Stepford Wives. Have you seen that? It's only the Nicole
Kidman. No, I haven't. No,
I'm
right.
A little curious about that because it looks so dated, and the 70s horror can sometimes hit in a different. I mean, I guess that's more sci-fi than horror. But Logan's Run, I never saw. Yeah. That deals with a killer robot. Demon Seed's on the list, and I did talk to you about that one that wanted to impregnate the woman.
You did.
Yeah, the evil house. Alien, of course, you got a killer robot in that first one. That's just Ian Holden is one of the scariest characters ever on screen in that.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a good connection there.
Blade Runner, Terminator, of course. And Megan does borrow scenes from Terminator, specifically the crawling front body of
the crawling Megan at the scene. End. Some of the just like the cold, dead eyes.
Yeah.
From a robot stare. Yeah.
But yeah, I love your comparison to Chucky because it actually, now that I think of it, is really a lot like Chucky, just with a, I guess, a more appeal because it's new property, new intellectual property.
But correct. It does
do a lot of the same moves.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this, I think there's no question that this idea is an updated Chucky movie.
Yes. Yeah. I completely agree with that, but I do
really.
Yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
I was going to say told really well with a really good story as far as dealing with grief.
Yes.
And they really didn't like lose that theme there. You know, like usually with a movie like this, it's a setup. Like, okay, this is just the vehicle to get the little girl to the aunt's house.
It's specifically but vehicle. That was a tired trope that I'd noted is just the parents dying in the snowstorm. I looked up a little statistics on this too. Only 900 people a year die in snowstorms. 76,000 are injured. So ratio wise, two dying and one surviving, it should be the opposite. But anyways, it was one of the tired tropes, but you're absolutely right. It did lead to a fresh take on grief with the aunt being a reluctant guardian.
Yes. Played by Allison Williams, who is becoming like a new horror hero.
Yes, she definitely is. Interestingly, you know? I was reminded of her character in Get Out by the kid Lydia, or not Lydia, I'm sorry, the kid Katie, or her niece that she adopts, who's then Megan's friend, the one that she attaches to.
Yeah.
Especially when she starts manipulating her into giving her back Megan. I saw flashes of Allison Williams' character manipulating the main in Get Out too. Anyways, I'm just wondering how much Allison Williams kind of directed the kid, because I felt a little Allison Williams in her.
Allison Williams, yeah.
And she was good. I mean, kid actors are tough to get on board with, but I enjoyed her enough. There was very few distracting moments.
Yeah, she had really great range, you know, from playing this a little bit of a spoiled brat in the beginning. Then you feel super sorry for her. Like, this poor girl is now in her aunt's home with toys she can't even play with. There's like absence of toys. So what do you do? How do you, you know, get comfortable in a new environment with an aunt who clearly cares about you, but maybe her job more?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely more. At one point when she's working on Megan, her friend and coworker is telling her, listen, if this is taking you away from time with her, that's not with your kid. And then she straight up says, it's not my kid.
Right.
I really loved that dynamic between them, because Allison Williams at times is not likable, but the kid is unlikable at times. But ultimately, in the end, you are on board with both of them. And it does have an organic sort of feel in how their bond was built.
Yes. And not only that, I really enjoyed the two coworker friends.
Yeah.
Like, I thought they were nice additions when you needed them, but you didn't. You could have told a story without them, but they really added a lot.
They did. You know, I wanted to ask you about the scene where Megan almost kills them. Do you think she purposefully let them live? Because she could have easily done them in, but she sets up a scenario where the guy was saved, even though he was being hung. He almost died. He was saved. Granted, she did penetrate the gas canister. So she kind of was trying to blow him up. But they are her co-creators. Located. You know, I think there's a chance some of these things that she does, there's a little bit of empathy in Megan, surprisingly. And I don't know. I thought Megan was one of the most complex of robots we've ever seen. And it really worked in that she was a young girl who spoke like a young girl in ways that kind of like were damaging to her. Allison Williams, right. Like cutting, because it's a little, it feels like a kid talking back to you sort of thing. Like when she says shut down, she's like, really? Are you sure about that?
Yeah.
You know, those sort of moments were way more effective than if Chucky had done it, you know, because of the nature of
definitely
a young girl.
Definitely. I think the whoever voiced Megan did such a good job. They created a new iconic, just, you know, you're going to be able to, years from now, when you can hear in your head, you know, Chucky's voice, here's Chucky, yeah. That you're going to be able to hear Megan's voice with your eyes closed and be like, that's yeah. iconic now.
Because it has great a voice young, acting. Like Alexa, Siri sort of vibe to it. You know what I mean? It had that undertone, that cadence, especially because the second yeah. time I watched it in 3x speed, and she sounds super robotic in that but yeah, actually,
explain to the audience why you did that.
Why I
explain to the audience really quick, so they don't think you watch all your movies 3x as fast. You were preparing for this, right?
Yes. Oh, I watch it at normal speed, yeah. of course, to begin with. But yeah, then when I want to take notes on it, I usually watch it at yeah. double speed or triple speed, even in the case of quadruple
sure
speed in the case
not...
of Skinamarink. Yeah. No, yeah, I'm not half-assed it here, people. I'm not
no,
honing it
no,
in.
No.
I did want to ask you, digress, what was your, at that age, what was the toy that you wanted desperately and needed? You would kick the back of your mom's seat while driving.
Well, let's make something clear here, that we both grew up in a time when we basically had toys created for us, like that for the first time, that was like demanding, like they created a toy and then a cartoon around it. They were
right.
marketing
yes.
the hell out of us.
Yeah.
So things like He-Man,
mm-hmm.
Ninja Turtles,
yes.
which are at the top of my list.
Me too.
Oh my God. Obviously G.I. Joe was huge. And then when Batman, the animated series came out, I became obsessed with those toys. But I would say one of the toys to kind of compare it to Megan was Teddy Ruxpin.
You loved your Teddy Ruxpin.
I love Teddy Ruxpin. They created a cartoon around it. Everything
wow.
was just marketed like it was just like, you have to have this. It plays.
Yeah.
I mean, I think I was really impressed with technology. I've always been impressed with it.
I loved me some
but
Small Bears.
Teddy Ruxpin.
As you can see, it's more along the lines of the Care Bear scene. Loved me some Care Bears.
Oh.
You know, I don't know if I ever told you, but I have this concept for an adaptation of Care Bears using people, but it's like, women with they've all been egregiously abused by men, so it's kind of like this misogynistic team who all get tattoos on their belly representing how they're going to get revenge, you know. Anyways, I digress.
That's fun.
For me, it was
That's
Teenage Mutant
fun.
Ninja Turtles for sure. I had to have that Technodrome,
yes. yeah.
you know.
Yeah.
That Technodrome was
had
essential.
To have
that
the van,
eyeball.
The party wagon.
Yeah, so I get it, it, especially given that we were the first gen, that it was really like advertising became super, super strong and, you know,
absolutely.
Permeated our minds beyond normal capacities.
Well, I thought it was brilliant how this movie opened with a commercial. I mean, it's basically just talking about, you know, consumerism and they pretty much nailed the tone of those old commercials.
Perpetual Pet.
Almost
was,
like Furby.
It was Furby. That can crap.
Yeah.
That was strange. It was so
funny, though.
Just focused on these
farting.
The potty jokes, the farting and feeding it so it can crap. And then these little
that
pebbles come
up, though.
It was hilarious. And it's funny that the name of the company is Funky, when, of course, Funko.
Yeah.
I'm super guilty of having collected way too many Funko Pops, so I get the need for things that these companies can put in you. But you're right, it was a good way to start it. It was a, what do they call that? Attention getter, the hook. It brought you in immediately.
Mm-hmm.
You knew what was gonna be the substance of the film, and yeah, I was on board with that. Let's talk Ronnie Chang. Ronnie Chang,
so funny.
Daily Show correspondent.
Daily
I don't know
Show.
Is he still a Daily Show correspondent?
Yeah, I believe so. Yeah.
I've seen him in another drama. I can't remember the name of it, but it's about a guy. It's essentially like a Groundhog Day, and he has like skin cancer in it. But I this wasn't the first time I'd seen him in something else. I enjoy him. My question is, was he too big? Because I thought for the most part, all the characters were pretty subtle. He was pretty big in this, wasn't he? Was it appropriately big?
Yeah.
Or was he just doing kind of the tired trope of the angry boss? Or did he put a new spin on it?
I think there was definitely some of that in there. I think he was almost like playing a character out of like Silicon Valley, that TV show.
Yeah, yeah.
That's actually a
good comparison. Well, yeah.
Who totally yell narcissistic. At you, like, go get me a kombucha.
Right. Yeah. And he was actually the comedic relief, so I got to give him credit for that, because there wasn't much else going on in that department. So essentially then we get the changing of Megan. What did you feel about the way I was annoyed by the montage where essentially we see her helping Katie in all these different ways? That annoyed me because
wash your hands.
Yeah.
Seriously?
I didn't mind the wash your hands because that was foreshadowing to her going crazy. That was the first moment you could tell she was like irritated when the kid wouldn't flush the toilet. The end of the montage was fine, but that bothered me. But I loved our first kill. What did you think about the first kill, the young man? Oh, no, actually, the dog is the first kill, right?
Yeah, technically, but you don't see it. And I'm happy for that. I don't need to see that. I don't like when they abuse the animals. Because it's PG-13.
That's
screen.
Something we got to note. We hadn't mentioned that. And that's something I wanted to ask you. Did we need gore? Because I honestly felt this was scarier than some R movies, despite it being PG-13.
Yeah. No, I think it's because it was leaning more towards like a thriller, like a almost like a 90s thriller, like single white female or, you know, the person becoming obsessed. And that's the terrifying part here. We get some blood. We get the paper, you know, chop. We see the ear get ripped off. We do see those moments, but they're not like over the top because it wasn't necessary.
That's true.
You might get a demand for it in the sequel because sequels got to dial things up. So you might see that then. But no, I think
the
insinuation
was good enough for me.
Usually I get turned off.
Well, yes. I got a question for you here.
Usually I get turned off by horror films.
The dog scene.
Have bad ratings.
She goes to reach for the arrow because Katie's playing with this little bow and arrow, this toy arrow that's on the other side of the fence where there's
suction
this
cup, yeah.
A rabid dog, essentially. She goes to get it for her. This is my question. Because she becomes a rag doll in that moment, and we know later she has the ability to fight back, is she baiting not only the dog, but Katie to come and get bitten by the dog?
I mean that's a great question. I don't know if I think it was just, you know, part of this heightening game.
Okay.
Of
the good
movie.
Doesn't that happen in The Good Son? There's this dog like on a bridge, and then Macaulay Culkin ends up killing it for Elijah Wood.
I think you're right.
Okay. All right. That's fair.
I think you're
there
right.
Was just these moments where I was wondering how calculated Megan was, because when we then jump to her killing the kid, she doesn't actually do it herself. This is the great moment where she's running like a, you know, an ape or something on the ground, the crawl run. But she kind of just scares him into going into the street, right? Tripping and then falling into the street.
Right.
I'm assuming she could hear that car coming and waited to the right moment.
Most likely.
I mean, if she has GPS coordinates, she would be able to do all that math to know
there.
If this kid is going to be running that way because he ran with her. She knows the speed in which he can run. I would love more of this, like, mathematical working out of how to kill people, you know, because that was not clear. Yeah. But I think there's the possibility she was using, you know, physics and anticipation sort of algorithms to take him out.
I think you're right. I think that's not necessarily a missed opportunity, but something that can definitely, you know, the more that Megan, you know, learns or advances, maybe that can come into play. But it's a good point. I mean, maybe there's a deleted scene we don't know about, but I think you do start to question, did she want to kill that kid, or did her plan get changed when he tripped? So who knows?
Right. What about the ear scene? So he's pulling his ear. Did you love it, or were you, was it a little too much for you?
You know what?
Because it looked a little ridiculous. Like the way the air stretched.
Can't
it do that? Like, that's one thing I want to know. Wouldn't it just kind of tear immediately? But
I think
it was cool. It was a funny moment to see that ear like 5 inches stretched out of his head, but it did seem a little cartoonish.
Yeah. Mr. Fantastic. I don't know. I don't know if it could do that. Maybe if it's got a precision hand like Megan, she can, you know, press down a certain way where it becomes pliable like that.
Yes. And of course, his ear getting ripped off does play a part later in the cops coming and realizing that it was.
Which
wasn't.
Is exactly what I said in the moment. I'm like, well, there's evidence. That's not going to look like an accident anymore.
Exactly.
But it needed to, she needed to leave something behind.
Yeah.
Even though you think, sorry, I was going to say, even though you would think that Megan's smart enough to know how to clean a crime scene.
I know. That's a really good point. It might have just had to do with timing. She wasn't able to go back.
Right.
I don't know. But another thing that I want to give it props for is that it deals with the issue of kids using too much technology. You know what I mean? In terms of it's highlighted when Katie gets adopted or whatever, taken in, and Gemma doesn't care that she's on her iPod all the time like her parents did. She has unlimited screen time. Kids like, what? So she kind of established that, you know what, tech is going to be your new parent.
That was a weird moment though when she said, wait, I can spend more time on there without saying it.
I liked it though, because I know, you know, good parents I think are limiting that. So it definitely
have to.
And then set up her coming to meet Bruce. Another trope that bothers me a little bit, the older model ultimately being responsible for disabling a lot of Terminator. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. It also kind of reminded me of like Big Hero 6. Did you ever see that movie? Like,
oh, yes.
An animated movie. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good one.
It definitely seemed a little bit of a trope. I guess that's also the movie RoboCop. You know, RoboCop 2, I think, when they have the advanced RoboCop.
Yeah, I mean, it is chock full of tired tropes, but there's enough good stuff, I feel like, that you're distracted by it, and it doesn't matter, because you are at that point invested enough in the characters to be like, okay, these are just plot things that have to happen, i.e. them having the fight in the dining room, and the girl not coming out of her room, like, that was ridiculous, right? That did not give me suspense, because I feel like the kid would have come out of the room. You know, she had established herself as pretty headstrong at that point, and now she's waffling whether or not to come out of her bedroom in that moment. It felt like that part could have been worked.
Think the only reason you can get away with that scene is that you have now established that Katie's not obsessed or under the spell, if you will, of Megan. I think there needed to be a moment where you know that she's going to come to her aunt's aid at some point, but why? So I don't know.
And it does lead to the good moment of where then Katie does come and it looks like she's going to buy into Megan's spiel and to ultimately kill the aunt. And she's reading her face and she's deciphering what all of her emotions are.
Yeah.
And it's Megan gets it wrong. She's the one that she's attached to, but she doesn't see that there's that animosity there. She's just seeing confusion, and this is the first time you see Megan's computation, the limits of robots, essentially the humanity, the thing that humanity has over the robots is that emotional side, and our own inner thoughts that can't be tapped. Like the robot ultimately is able to tap all other hardware. So that was good. And it was a subtle way to do it. It wasn't overt, hitting you over the head with humans are different than robots.
Right. But do you think there's a scene early on when the engineers are first putting that new plastic face on Megan and they're like, wait a minute, why doesn't she? Yeah, the confusion. Yeah, right.
The smirk. That's, look. I look like a smirk,
the smirk
to me.
Yeah. So that's them saying that AI doesn't understand every emotion because it can't.
Yeah. Yeah, there was subtle moments where that differentiate that I think ultimately
paid that was
off.
The foreshadowing of her scanning her face and like, oh,
and it was scary.
She gets certain confused. Yeah.
The little smirk was a good way to start it off. And then her head explodes after she makes these really demonic yeah. screams. That was enjoyable as well.
Yeah.
Some funny lines too. And like Ronnie Chang is all like, yeah, this is great. Let's kick Hasbro right in the dick with it or something.
Right. In
enjoyed
the dick.
That. There's some funny lines in it yeah. for sure.
Yeah, there were.
Okay. Let's talk about the death of the neighbor, because that was a new death. We'd never seen that in horror before.
Right. Well,
what'd you think?
I almost thought she was like literally going to pump her with it and like shove it down her mouth and shove it down her throat.
That would have been probably better and clearer.
Yeah, because maybe it's the whole PGR thing that we couldn't show too much of that. But were we to believe, because Allison Williams' character alludes to the fact that she calls it like poison when it's dripping into her driveway.
Ah.
That
yes.
we're just supposed to believe that.
Is it just the poison? Dang. Okay, that makes it even worse for me, because I thought it was a power washer. But you're right, it was the poison that we see earlier.
It was. Yeah, it was
the power washer would have been
the
sweet.
Chemicals.
Because that's what I initially absolutely. Thought it was. I looked it up, like, can a power washer actually, you know, hurt you? And apparently it does go through flesh, but it can't go through bone. So if it was a power washer, the R-rated version is you see her start to like blow away viscera, and then you cut to she's essentially power washed the woman down to just her skeleton. That's the R-rated version I needed to see. I wanted to see.
I think the only reason they didn't use a power washer is because power washers turn on and they're loud.
Fair. That's
so
a good
maybe
point.
That's a reason they went with this. But if you remember at the end of it, this is like in the 1960s, 70s, where you really weren't showing death scenes and everything was like alluded to. They show what looks like blood draining into the drain. So does the chemical start to melt her face?
Eat away her? I don't know. I like that. All right. Thank you for reminding me that possibility is there.
Yeah.
Because it was weird. Absolutely. I loved the little cat and mouse thing where she's using the dog. She's imitating a dog. You never really imitating human voices, T2 style, but this is the first time I think I've heard imitating an exact dog's little whimper, believably enough for the owner to come and think that was fun. But the poison, not as impressive to me.
No.
Nevertheless.
It was just to show her how sinister Megan can be. Like, she led her there and then just murdered her. Like,
yeah,
she's just leaving a trail of bodies that point back to her, though. So she ultimately was her own demise.
I got a question for you. If it wasn't doesn't become murderous, would you want a robot like that? Because I know Elon Musk is in the process of making these $10,000 home bots that can essentially do everything a human can do. Would you want one of those?
No, no way. No way. And it's not because, like a lot of people, I'm scared of AI. I'm annoyed by it. The fact that, you know, ultimately it's just going to replace jobs. I really, really loved the line that the therapist, who at first I didn't like, then I end up liking her, when she basically calls Allison Williams out and says, you know, there's this attachment theory. And what happens when they get too old and the doll stays the same age? It's very weird. They're going to,
I'm glad she got a little
someone to grow.
She got a wake up call there. Unfortunately, it was from a character that I loathed, especially when she first visits. She's just obnoxious.
When she first visited, I hated her. Yes. Like, so judgmental. Like, give her a break.
I know. That
it's
really
not like she's
put me
abusing
off.
This child.
Exactly. Because she wants to show her how to use the toy, that she's overpowering the will of the kid. It just didn't make any sense to me. But
now to loop it back to your question, no, I don't ever want a robot like that. I think it's super creepy. It lacks so much of what humans can provide. And then, you know, ultimately, because our society and humans are sick, it's going to become a sex thing.
That's
and
true.
And I think that is, you know, it is. You know, it is.
That's a really
good point.
People
are disgusting. It will become a sex thing. And they're going to be like, well, another person died while trying to have sex with their AI robot.
Yeah, no, that's a fair yeah. point. But that is that necessarily horrible for people like incels, maybe, who wouldn't shoot up schools if they had a sex robot sort of thing? Oh. I mean, Rick and Morty kind of deals with that, even though they can't talk about Rick and Morty anymore. You know what? I agree that it seems it would be superfluous in my life. I'm trying to think, what could it do for me? Could go get me a beer. I could wash the toilet, things that I wouldn't want to do, right?
Right. But the things
I don't think it would be worth $10,000 for the though. Things it would do for me, you know?
The things that make us human, those annoyances, those the things that you have to do, otherwise we are lazy animals that don't deserve this earth if we just have robots yeah. do all of our bidding.
Well, okay, I'm going to take point with something you said in terms of robots taking our jobs, because the jobs that they are taking, I don't yeah. think are jobs people want for the most part. You know what I mean? And if it does, if we do ultimately, we're leading, if we can aim toward a utopia, rather, it would be where robots did the banal jobs and hard jobs that we don't want to do that destroy your body and mind, so that people can, you know, do art and beautiful things that they'd want to do.
Right. If it's a matter of safety, and like, now we don't have to risk humans doing this job because it was super dangerous. Like, even the window washers that are up 1,000 feet.
Mm.
I mean, that's a job. But here's the thing, at the end of the day, if you replace these jobs that are like the benign, it's still costing someone who doesn't have the right training or education, you know. You're making those individuals moot, or, you know, you're removing.
Right. And
here's the other thing.
I'm pro basic income, you know what I mean? I would be all for, you know, Andrew Yang's plan, because he's the one that kind of like spouted off about
yes.
this. But if you Andrew have a Yang. Different general system, then those people wouldn't need these crappy jobs where they're universal existing. Yeah. Yeah, universal basic income, sorry.
This is exactly what happens. If you start replacing jobs, now people can't do those jobs. They're at home. They don't have a way of making income. It will destroy the economy. So now you have to pay people. What are people going to do?
This is what I was saying before. Existence? I think it opens people up to do what they want and to follow their passions. But the counterpoint to that would be if there's 7 billion more people suddenly able to do artistic things, does that then diminish art? You know
does
what
it
I mean?
Diminish art? Yeah. Yes. Yes.
If it's,
yes.
It'd be just like a overwhelming amount. It's not going to then have that same power. Yeah.
I mean, I totally appreciate you. And even if you are playing devil's advocate here, I appreciate it, because it's definitely a conversation that's going to continue happening. Andrew Yang was on CNN this week talking about AI and how it's, and how right now college students are using it to write papers. Right. And it's, we've already have some technology in our lives that has made humans' lives simpler, but are we dumber for it? Probably. You know, you've got students in school with iPads now, right?
Right.
Now you don't have people. No, you don't know how to use an encyclopedia. You don't know. And I know that's a bit of the past, but I still think people need to learn that stuff.
I mean, I agree, but I just worry that we're kind of antiquated in that thought at this point. And I think about one school that I did teach that had iPads. It was just so easy for the kids to cheat, because I tried to do quizzes and stuff via the iPad and stuff, but they were sharing screens without me knowing sort of stuff.
Oh,
and
wow.
It's just impossible to regulate at some point.
And if anything, it's just teaching them to cut corners better. You know, sharing screens isn't the thing I was thinking of. I just thought you could look up the answers, but no. It makes them better at being worse.
Yeah, no, that's true. Yeah, it's a tricky topic, and certainly
absolutely
we're not really a political or philosophical podcast here, but it speaks to the quality of Megan that we would even divert into deeper stuff like that. So I got
to
give it credit for that.
To question these things 100%. Yeah, I mean, it's inevitable. It's not going away. It's only going to get better. And I think Andrew Yang even said right now, you have AI that is equivalent to the Model T, you know, the Ford Model T car. But it's not going to take years for it to become a Ferrari or a Lamborghini, whoever he said it. It's going to take months, if not a year, weeks, months for it to, jump to the next level.
Have you heard about this new, speaking of technology, the fusion that they've now been able to do and essentially get more energy than they put in, which could be the future of how everything is energized? Supposedly that is going to take decades to actually be commercialized because it's such a hard thing to do. But I agree, when it comes to robotics and computing, that is definitely exponential growth.
Yeah. Yes. And the fusion conversation, and yes, I did hear about it. It was fascinating.
It is.
It's they're using lasers, you know, to basically cut down, but they're talking about long-term, basically having fusion to be able to like power things and to clean up our but right now, for them to even develop what they're doing, they're still using like electricity. Yeah. So
that's a good point. Yeah. Who knows? It's very exciting and very terrifying at the same time.
Absolutely.
Both of these.
And it's ripe for horror.
It is.
Ripe for horror.
You know? Definitely is. It's a great genre that right now it doesn't have enough amazing entries. I would say this is a really good, it's like a B plus entry in this genre for me right now.
Oh, yeah.
And yeah, I definitely would suggest it.
It goes back to what we were saying with when we were talking about Smile. It's another great entry into kind of big budget, even though the budget was smaller, you know, blockbuster horror, which, you know, I'm a fan of. It gets more people out to see horror.
And that's true.
I think Megan did that.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's the schema that you're talking about that makes it mainstream. These tropes that we saw, like ultimately the annoying neighbor's going to die, the pet's going to die, the bully's going to die. All these things happen in all these movies. And that is the predictable side. But your characters and like the underlying plot are what can change and become more interesting than the devices.
There's two more characters I want to talk about really quickly. The last thing I really have to say is I loved the cop that kept showing up. I thought he was just had a really fun thing about him. But what I thought was weird is we have a detective character that we really only see once. He shows up and he's explaining things and he's like, oh, I shouldn't laugh at that.
The guy who found the ear, really, right? Is
that it? Yes. And he's like, oh, I shouldn't laugh about that.
Right.
I thought it was interesting that I bet you there had to have been one more scene that they cut him out, because why introduce the detective when we really could have had the police officer say, I'm relaying information, following up on behalf of a detective.
You're absolutely right. That seems unnecessary unless they're trying to set up plot for Megan 2 sort of stuff. You never know.
Yeah.
But.
Yeah,
you're right. It did. That is. I didn't even remember him when you said detective. I'm like, when is it?
It was a small, funny character, though. He was really goofy.
Hey, good. Yeah,
but the other cop was super fun. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I thought for the most part, casting wise, it was great. I was really annoyed with our therapist, the social worker, rather.
Unnecessary evil, you know. I agree with you. The intro to her character, I thought, you're really kind of coming in, and you know, it's a child's, you know, welfare that we're talking about here, so she has every right. However, her tact, I thought, well, give this woman a break.
Allison Williams has not established any reason for her to be wary yet, you know, because they had just I'd like to kick her right in the
necessary.
Dick. But yeah, I think that's all I got on this one too. I really enjoyed it.
Same.
And I'm looking forward to 2. I really like how they have subtle moments, like when Megan's first starting to suss stuff out on her own, which is interesting, that conversation where she said, you made me figure this out. It's like kids do. It's like, I didn't want to be born. You're the one that had me. You know, it's like that sort of whiny business that I did appreciate. And I love the moment before the dog attack where she sees the butterfly on the window. Right? Something that can fly, that's natural and beautiful.
And then the helicopter.
Then the helicopter, something that is more akin to her, that is more powerful and, you know, commanding. She's essentially in that moment, I think that's when it clicks. I'm the superior being that does everything that you can do.
Mm-hmm.
Might not be as pretty, especially when she loses half of her hair.
Oh my God. Yes. Well, let me just, you know, I know you said you didn't have anything else to say about that, but let me pose this: predictions. So
it's got to go on a grander scale, right? You think it's going to be Allison Williams again, or are we moving elsewhere?
I think Allison Williams will be involved somehow. Here's the thing, though. They set up that scene where that assistant, he's copying all the files over.
Yeah.
So I'm equating it to the scene in Jurassic Park where the the DNA gets off the island. But we also end our shot. Our final scene is on, is it Kate? Casey? Basically the Alexa of the house.
Yes.
They had paired. Now we know that there's a connection. So how are we bringing Megan back to life in the
You're
in
right.
The
I sequel? Think it was Kelsey, maybe? Yeah, at the Kelsey, end, we do get that yes. trope of, okay, she's still in the hardware there, in the software, rather.
And watching.
And able to control the hardware. What would she have to do? She maybe could take over Bruce and make herself a new being or something. Right. Not exactly sure. I feel like I don't remember him copying over the files, but it would seem more like a Ronnie Chang than would still want. Oh no, he's dead. Someone like a Ronnie Chang in Funky,
right.
In the company would then want to use that nefariously.
Yes. So Ronnie Chang actually catches this guy. He copies the files over, and Ronnie Chang walks up. He slams the computer down. He's like, "Were you watching Pornhub?"
The Dennis Nedry of Megan. 100%.
Yes.
The avenue in. That information has been passed on to Hasbro, you know, or whoever he was sending it to. That's it's going to be legions of Megans, probably, or their version of Megan.
That's exactly where my brain was going. We've seen that in the new Chucky TV show, though. We've seen that. I really hope that they find a clever way of doing it, because I really think there's future here. And the last thing I'll say is that clearly, doll horror is never going away.
Never going away. Hell no. And the last thing I'll say is stay alive.